You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Joining me now is Nita Prose. Her debut novel is The Maid, and it has spent the last couple of months at the or near the top of the New York Times bestseller list because it's a really good and highly enjoyable novel. Nita Prose, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you. I was made aware of your novel last summer, almost a year ago. Yi Wan Sun from Random House sent me a note to make sure that it was on my radar, and it has been. So you've been involved in the publishing world for a while, so it must be incredibly exciting to suddenly be the one whose book is getting all the attention.
Well, it's so strange. Like, it has felt Alice in Wonderland, like I'm living in some sort of upside down world so many times. I'm starting to collect all these moments where I'm like, wait a second, I'm the one who's supposed to be over there, not over here. You know, like right now, you know, I'm the one who's supposed to be in the background listening in as my author is talking to you. I'm not supposed to actually be speaking here.
So it's strange, I guess.
Yeah, no, but strange in the very, very best way. And, you know, what can I say? I've only ever been good at one thing. That's telling stories or helping other people tell stories. So in so many ways, this transition or not transition, because I do both at the same time, editing and writing, just feels like the most natural progression in the world.
So this is your first published novel, but is it your actual first novel?
It is my actual first novel. I have worked as a ghostwriter, but in the nonfiction realm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, tell me about that. What kinds of nonfiction books have you worked on?
Well, you know, all kinds, really. I've worked with astronauts and singers and musicians and politicians and. So, you know, my job for non-expert writers is to guide them through the process, to collaborate them when to capture their stories and their voices on the page.
Are you allowed to say who you've ghostwritten for, or it's like you're not supposed to?
You know, it's most of them are not like very well guarded secrets, but you know, there is confusion that takes place because it's their stories that I'm helping them tell. And it's not as though I'm inventing from scratch. So, you know, my feeling is, well, if people wanted to, if the clients themselves want to speak about that, they may, and they so often do. But otherwise I don't tend to say those names out loud.
But has that been a rewarding experience to help them tell their story?
Oh, absolutely. You know what? I've learned so much from that process, and I've been allowed to be very close to people who, you know, so often are reluctant to tell their stories, but when they do and they open up with me and therefore with their readers, the process can be really restorative, lovely, and a real gift to their fans.
So how did you get involved in publishing? Well, let's go back even before that. Where are you from originally?
I am from Canada, Toronto, Ontario-ish, just outside of Toronto. And, you know, I went to university here and I stayed in this city ever since.
So you still live up there?
Yes, I do.
Well, you're lucky.
You're not the first person to say that, especially in the last few years.
That's right. Yeah, I bet you were afraid we were all coming up there.
Yeah, I was like, okay, great. At least I have a lot of pullout couches.
And your family still lives up there?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
And they must be very proud of you.
They are. They're so absolutely adorable. My brother has started collecting my editions on a special shelf in his office, and which he periodically updates and sends me photos of. It's adorable.
And so you got involved in publishing out of school? Is that what happened?
Or? No, actually, I was a teacher before, and I taught special needs students. And I did that for quite a few years. And then, you know, I was doing in some ways so much of what I do now, same thing, teaching people about stories and helping them write. But I, you know, I really wanted to venture out into the publishing world. I thought that would be the right spot for me. And as it turns out, it really was.
It was. So I was a teacher for a long time.
What did you teach, Gary? I know I'm turning the interview around, but I can't help myself.
I was a middle school teacher for 30 years. I still teach at Monterey Peninsula College. I teach film appreciation here in California. And I taught middle school in Salinas, California for 30 years.
That's amazing.
I had a lot of special needs kids. As a matter of fact, every kid is a special needs kid.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I think that is in so many ways, the best teaching is individualized to the student.
Yeah. So, right. So students who get individualized instruction because of some kind of special need usually do much better. So what level of teaching did you do?
I taught high school. And, you know, it was a really formative time and experience for me in so many ways. And I wonder if you experienced this, Gary, in your teaching career. Was there ever a time when, you know, you went in as the teacher performing your role and you came out in so many ways as the student?
Every day.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Now you must have been one of those people that the high school students thought was one of the students, because you still look like you could be a high school student.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm so far away from that. I am a tendered 49 years and a half. However, yeah, I do tend to look a little bit younger and always have. I'm good with that now. But let me say, when I was 16, it was just the worst, and I only prayed for looking older.
Well, I used to look really young, but I grew out of it. When I first started teaching, my students would say, you know, how old are you, Mr. Shapiro? I'd say, well, I'm 35 years old. 35? You don't look 35. You look so young. And then, you know, then at the end, they would say, how old are you? I'd say, I'm 65. They go, oh.
Oh, that's the end of that conversation. There's nothing to say. You could be my great-grandfather, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, I no longer look young, but oh well. I have a face for radio, so it's perfect. So you left academia and went into publishing.
Yes. And, you know, it didn't take me long to realize that I was so at home there. And, you know, this is how I knew I was at home. I could spend hours at a photocopier, because in these days, this is how we had to make backups, using a photocopier. And I would photocopy manuscripts that were returned by authors, and wherein there would be these marginal conversations between the editor and the author that I got to watch happen on the page. And of course, it was so exciting for me to be part of those conversations and to see what takes place in the development of a novel or a work of nonfiction. And I was absolutely entranced from that moment on.
Well, I mostly talk with nonfiction authors because it's hard to talk about novels, because you don't want to give away your novel, which I'm very conscious of not giving away anything about The Maid, because although it's a novel, it's a thriller, certainly, maybe not in the you know, it's not like a Ludlum or something, but it's still, yeah. it's a mystery, and it's a great book, and I love it, and everyone loves it, because obviously you don't need my help publicizing it. It's already the number one bestseller in the world, and it was the Good Morning America Book Club. There's a sticker right on there. I didn't know they had programming on that early in the morning, but apparently they do. And
you're wise to miss it. Let me just say, I get up at such an absurd hour to write that I believe you me, I'm not missing much.
Is that your, is that how you work your day? You write in the morning?
Yes, because of course I still do work as an editor. So I wake up at 5 and that's when my work day begins. And I do my shift in that wonderful liminal time of the day when the phones aren't buzzing and the emails aren't coming in, except from the UK. And I just find it's a time when I'm a little bit closer to the dream state still and not quite entirely awake. And for me, there's something about that allows me to play and to really exist more fully in the world of fiction.
So when did you realize, oh, I got a good novel in me that I have to write?
Well, this is how it happened. I mean, I love my work as an editor, so I didn't really plan to write a debut novel. But in 2019, I was at the London Book Fair, which is this big book fair that happens, brings publishers from all around the world in London, England. And I was staying at a hotel. I went out for a business meeting and I came back. And I opened my hotel room door and I completely startled the roommate who was cleaning it. And I remember her just sort of jumping back into a shadowy corner. And And I looked at her, and the embarrassing part is she was holding my track pants, which, of course, like a fool, I had left in a tangled mess on my bed because I'd gone for a run that morning. And in my rush to go to my meeting, I just threw them on the bed. And she was, you know, folding them up so she could make the bed. And I looked at her and I just thought, it's such an invisible and intimate job to be a roommate. You know, she'd been cleaning my room day after day, and she knew so much about me. And I knew not the first thing about her. And that's, it was funny, Gary. It was like one of those little kernel moments that just sort of sticks in your brain. You forget about it. You get on with your day. But then, you know, a few days later, I'm on my plane ride home after a very successful trip. And that's when I started to hear the voice of a maid. And it was the voice of Molly. It was very clean. It was clear. It was precise. And, you know, I grabbed the napkin from under my drink because I didn't have any paper. And I started to write the prologue to The Maid in a single burst. And wow. Even then, I didn't know it. But that is the moment when I began my debut novel.
How great. So a great idea just popped into your head. And it is a wonderful, yep. It's a wonderful idea. And she is a great character that is obviously somewhere on the spectrum, I guess you would say. I mean, did you have to do some research into that area of it, or did you just make that up?
Well, you know, I'd never call her out that way, and I never specify or give her any labels whatsoever. And one of the reasons that I decided not to do that was because I didn't want the reader to make any assumptions about her, you know, to read the cover copy and then go, oh, she's not like me. She's somebody else. Or she is like me. I wanted them to go in completely free from that and just discover what it is to be Molly. And my intention is that the reader sits behind her eyes, that we live as her. We experience life and what it is like to work as a maid in a 5-star hotel, which means to be largely invisible most of the time. And my hope is that if you live that experience for a little while, you come to love Molly.
Well, although it would be sort of far-fetched for Molly to now encounter some other mystery, will she, do you feel like this is a standalone, or we'll see Molly again?
You know, I don't know. This is what I keep saying about that. It's such a hard problem to solve. You know, my intention is to really make readers love this character. And part of the byproduct of that is that readers wouldn't necessarily want more if they've enjoyed this book.
Yeah.
So my challenge then as a writer is to actually give them more or the same, but not less. And that is a very tricky proposition. And I can say that I won't release more of Molly and, you know, her world unless I feel I'm going to please readers and do her justice.
Now, do you have other characters and stories rattling around in your head? I mean, you
just, oh my goodness. Yeah. It's just a community center up there. It's like the bingo hall. It's just everyone clamoring to be heard. I have many characters and many ideas for stories. And, you know, I'm mulling over what my next one is going to be. I'm definitely working on a few things at the moment. I just haven't quite said what my next move is going to be.
Well, we'll all be looking forward to it. Now, what about the future of The Maid? Will there be it seems like it's the perfect 6-part, streaming series that people will binge watch.
So the good news is that Universal Pictures has actually picked up the option for the film. And Florence Pugh, who was, of course, in Black Widow and was the award, Academy Award nominee for Little Women and has been in so many other great films like Midsummer, Little Drummer Boy. She is set to star as Molly the Maid, which I just am so tremendously excited about. I just think she is somebody who makes the most unusual choices on screen. So I can't wait to see what she does with a character like Molly.
Oh, that's incredible. You must be excited about that.
I am tremendously excited. Yeah.
Well, it's just a wonderful book. And like I said, we don't want to give away any of the story, but we've already given away a lot.
yeah, but no spoilers.
No.
You know, we don't know who killed Mr. Black, and we do know he dies in the first chapter. So,
yeah. That's not so much of a spoiler. And we know nothing happens to her because she's telling us the story.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and my guest right now is Nita Prose. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Maid.
So do you think you will be involved in the writing of the screenplay?
I won't be writing the screenplay because I definitely know my limits. And I know that that is a very singular craft, and I trust the great people at Universal and the wonderful executive producers that I'm working with. And I can say, you know, there's not too much I can say about that, but I can say that what's happening on the screenwriting front is so incredibly exciting and that I cannot wait for next steps.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Now, you know, I don't know. You're saying that you still work, in your job as an editor. Do you think that, I mean, I have absolutely no idea about the financial rewards today of a best-selling novel. Is it enough? Will you be able to someday just write and not do anything else?
I might be. I just don't know if that's what I want. I'm in the very luxurious position of sort of figuring out my own destiny and what makes sense to me. The thing about my editing work is that it really fuels me. You know, working with other writers to solve creative problems actually refills me with strength and stamina to tackle my own. So I really love that. I love the fact of working parallel to other people on problems that might not be the same, but might be related. So in some way, I want to be able to continue my career and keep working. And I must say, you know, people that I work with have been really good about being able to accommodate a few massive changes in things in order to allow me to, you know, promote my book in January, let's say, which yeah, I did a lot of.
I'm sure. Well, when you were writing your book, and apparently it didn't take all that long because you got the idea in 2019 and I knew about it in 2021, so a couple of years to write it. Did you find that reading other people's work was a good thing or a bad thing when you were working on your own thing?
I always find that a good thing. Sometimes if it's a little too close genre-wise to mine, I might steer away for a little bit just so I don't pick up on influences and those seep into my own world. But for the most part, you know, I'm a voracious reader. And of course, my job is all about assessing manuscripts, developing manuscripts and so on. So I find that gives me more energy. It doesn't take it away.
Well, you know, this book was listed as one of the most anticipated books. I think the New York Times called it one of the most anticipated books of 2022, which must have been gratifying. And, I'm in the publishing world in that I do a radio program about books. And so I get books all the time and I get emails every day telling me about books and way more books than I have time to read or have the interest in reading. So there's this enormous amount of literature out there. So were you able to use your connections in the publishing industry to get The Maid looked at, or did you have to go through that just like anybody else would?
I had to go through it just like anyone else, however, with an extra layer of stigma. So allow me to explain. So this is a question I've gotten before, and it's just so funny because it's so, you know, some of the assumptions around it are so different from the reality. And the first one is that, yes, of course, I know lots of people in the publishing industry. But, you know, when somebody from our industry turns their hand to writing, let's just say it isn't always met with, you know, raving enthusiasm. Most of the time it is met with a giant eye roll. So I knew that while I was writing. And one of the things that terrified me more than anything was the moment that, you know, I would decide, okay, my manuscript's done. You know, I'm going to send it off now into the publishing world and to agents and see what people's reactions were. Because unlike so many other people, after I did that, I would never be able to unsee the reactions on those people's faces. I would have to go on working with them day after day, even after, in my mind, I had told myself the story. I would hand in my work to agents and they'd say, oh, it's really lovely. Oh, it's very nice. Which is, you know, code for, oh my goodness, this is unpublishable drivel, and don't you ever try writing again. So all of those sort of psychological barriers were definitely in my mind as I was sending out my manuscript. And I was definitely terrified about the reaction and incredibly relieved when, of course, people were more interested than I could have imagined.
That must have been gratifying. I mean, because you know about this. I mean, there must be a pile of manuscripts everywhere in your house. Although what I can see, everything is very neat and clean.
Yeah, this is a complete illusion, I assure you. yes, my little setup here for listeners is very neat and clean. And there are, you know, a few books and some flowers and a teacup and so on. But no, there is chaos and post-it notes and piled manuscripts and, as you said, galleys, advanced readers copies of books all over the place. And it's a wonderful jumble.
Now, have you had an experience like that when you discovered something out of a pile and said, oh my gosh, this is great?
Absolutely. Yes.
And did that thing end up being a successful book for the author?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many of those success stories that are from the slush pile, as we call it, you know, unsolicited manuscripts that don't necessarily come through an agent, or may sometimes come through an agent, but, you know, maybe that's a person without too much of a track in the publishing world, or, you know, not much publishing experience. And it is the most exciting thing. It's like going to a garage sale and coming across a Fabergé egg. You know, it's just like, you know, those stories of people wandering into a garage sale and they come out with a Picasso. And it's like, it feels like that. It's the editorial version of that. And it is the most exciting thing.
You were talking about your ideas for your next book. And, you know, this book has already been, it's been out here now for months. So how much longer will people have to wait? Do you feel like this pressure, like, oh, I better do something? Because, I mean, if you wait 5 years or 6 years,
we won't be waiting 5 years. No, no, no. yeah, sure. There's pressure. Yeah. But for me, it's the good kind of pressure. And I wouldn't want it any other way. I know that there are a lot of readers out there who are willing to give me a little bit more of their time and attention on another book. I mean, my goodness. I feel like the luckiest person in the world for that. And my job now is just to honor that and give them something good to read.
Well, I can't wait. I'll just sit here and wait. In fact,
I suggest maybe picking up another book while you're waiting, maybe doing a few more podcasts, because it might take me a few months.
All right, I'll do that. But when that new book comes, will you come back and talk to me about it?
I would love to, Gary. I would love to so very much. So please don't forget about me. I'll be gone for a little while, but I would love to come back.
The book is called The Maid, and the author, the brilliant Nita Prose. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary, and thank you to all your listeners.
That was Nita Prose, author of the bestseller The Maid. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO.
Joining me now is author Karen Joy Fowler. Her books include the New York Times bestseller The Jane Austen Book Club, Sister Noon, Sarah Canary, and We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves. Karen Joy Fowler has won many awards and honors for her work, and her new novel is Booth, an epic novel about the family behind one of the most infamous figures in American history, John Wilkes Booth. Karen Joy Fowler, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hello, happy to be here.
So were you drawn to write about John Wilkes Booth because you have three names and he has three names?
I was not drawn to write about John Wilkes Booth. I was drawn to write about his brothers and sisters, of which he had a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this novel is historical fiction, but it feels like the research he must have done to recreate life in the 19th century, it had to have been enormous. And I know you'd written about the family in an earlier collection, so the story has to have been in your mind for a long time. How long have you been working on Booth?
I've been working on Booth for about 6 years, but you have to understand that, unlike real writers, I don't work steadily. You know, it's not like for 6 years I've been getting up every morning and working on this book. I have long periods where I write a lot, and then I have long periods where I'm not working at all. And so I, in terms of how many hours I actually put in, I couldn't tell you because it's very intermittent.
Well, when you're not working, I mean, when you're not physically writing, are you working on the story in your head? Is it
German? I think so. Sometimes, you know, very consciously, and sometimes I think very unconsciously. I think my agent told me once that I'm a really slow writer. And I thought that's not true at all. I'm a really fast writer. I'm just a really slow thinker. So, you know, once I know what I want to do with the next few pages, I can do that fairly quickly, but it takes me a long time to figure out where the story is going to go next.
So you don't, you don't have an idea in it with a novel that you know exactly where it's going necessarily.
No, actually, Booth was sort of an anomaly in that respect because the story is written. You know, everybody knows where the story.
Oh, no spoilers! No spoilers. Yes, no.
Everybody knows where it's going to end.
Somebody might get killed by one of your characters.
Yeah, but we won't say who. Won't say who. So yeah, but in general. As I make my way through a novel, I don't know where I'm going to go with it. And so I'm making it all up as I go along, which is a method I like because it, you know, keeps me interested, keeps the sort of problem solving aspect of the novel, which I enjoy, something that I'm engaged in, but requires a lot of rewriting because frequently, you know, I'll make a decision and it won't turn out to have been a good decision. And I'll have to make a different decision and go back and rewrite all those pages. And that's okay too, because I like rewriting, but slow method.
You can change the history that you've created.
Yes.
You're all powerful, I guess, when you're,
you better believe it.
You're like a god, a goddess, I should say. Well, it seems like in the 19th century, mostly everybody dies. I mean, how difficult was it to live to be, say, 10 years old, let alone 60 years old?
It's one of the, one of the things that I think is hard for us to wrap our heads around, that, you know, that two families that I'm looking at, primarily the Booths, but also the Lincoln family. You know, they lost children at a terrifying rate. And I cannot believe that that was any less painful to them, for all that it was more common than it would have been for us. I think the death of four of the Booth children deformed the family in ways that, again, it's hard for us to quite wrap our heads around you're a hostage to fortune when you have a child, but in that time and place and the years preceding, you were really a hostage to fortune.
Yeah, it's really it's amazing now because people are living so long. I mean, you and I mean, we're not old at all. We're young, but we're older than everybody in your story.
For sure. Yeah. I'm willing to be considered old at this point. I'll take it.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is KSCO Santa Cruz, and I'm talking with Karen Joy Fowler. Her latest novel is called Booth.
How much of what you do is made up, and how much of it is his history in historical fiction?
I tried to the extent that I was able to stick to the things that actually happened. So very little in the book is made up in terms of the events. You know, I know where the Booths were at different points in their lives. I knew who was living in what household and who was at boarding school and you know, what the major events that might be happening. But of course, I don't really know the people. So the parts I made up involve what they were thinking, what they talked about at the dinner table, all the little bits of family life that seem plausible to me, but also fictional.
In the early pages of your book, I really love this sort of the little children's torturing of each other with various, you know, the rivalries among the children and so on. That felt very, very real. And that's the stuff that you obviously are creating out of your head. Did you come from a large family? Where did you get all that?
No, I have one brother, and he's enough older than me that rivalry was not possible on my part. There was no way for me ever to win any sort of rivalry. Asia, the younger of the girls, left quite a record of their lives in letters and in books, and she referred to incidents in their childhood. So a lot of that came from her and from out of the research.
Well, so talk a little bit about the research. I mean, when you say that you worked on it for 6 years, how much of that time was spent doing research, and what kinds of research did you do?
With every book that I write, I usually read for about a year before I start. I start actually writing, and the whole time I'm reading, I'm kind of looking for my story. I'm trying to figure out who I might put in it and where things might happen in a fictional, more fictional book. You know, I would have more latitude in making those decisions, but I do research for everything that I write, and I don't expect to be admired for that. I quite enjoy it. I love the year that I spend just reading. In the case of the Boos, there was a great deal of material. This is a well-researched family, and there are lots of Booth aficionados out there. So the tricky part in this particular case was separating mythology about the family from facts that seemed more solid. So, you know, we live in a time where we understand that eyewitness accounts are very unreliable. And so the historical record is very unreliable. And you add to that an event of the magnitude of the assassination, which just changes how everybody thinks they remember events. It's very important when you're looking at a description of John Wilkes Booth by an acquaintance to know whether this description was written before or after the assassination, because afterwards people thought that they had always seen things that they maybe had not always seen. So that was the tricky part. There are a number of stories told about the Booths, and retold. They appear in many sources, but if I try to track them back to their origins, sometimes they seem very doubtful to me. Hmm. And then some of the ones that you would think could not possibly be true, there is evidence to support, such as the fact that the oldest girl, Rosalie, the very shy, kind of reclusive oldest girl in the family, fell in love with a lion tamer. couldn't make up a better love life for her than this longed for lion tamer.
Well, I've always been curious about this. How, in terms of the way we think of fame today, how famous was John Wilkes Booth and Edwin Booth at the time of the assassination? Could you correlate it with someone today?
They were very famous. They had a kind of they were kind of early examples of celebrity culture, where young women would come to their performances, and the stage managers would have to come out and ask the ladies to please behave like ladies while the Booth brothers were performing. And I read somewhere that, and this was a few years ago, so we would probably possibly pick a different actor now. But one account I read was, in order to understand the impact of this, you would have to imagine that Brad Pitt had a younger brother, and that one day you woke up and the headline in the newspaper was that Brad Pitt's younger brother had murdered the president. That's the closest you could come to to understanding the how cataclysmic this event was. For I mean, it would have been cataclysmic no matter who murdered Lincoln.
Right,
but it was particularly shocking that it was someone famous.
Now, the assassination itself, there's been lots of books, incredibly
lots and lots of books, yeah.
And I guess again, I want to avoid spoilers in your novel, but to some degree, you let those books speak for themselves. You don't really give us. You don't take us inside in a real moment by moment kind of way into the assassination to that extent.
No, I don't. I don't go into John Wilkes Booth's head at any point in the novel. I just look at the people around him and what they thought of him and what their interactions with him were, trying to sort of create a character out of that negative space. And I don't have a clue what he was thinking when he murdered President Lincoln, and I don't want to pretend that I do. I do think one thing that is very clear to me is that it was a performance, that he planned it, and he gave himself lines, and he gave himself blocking, and he had it all choreographed in his head, how it was going to work. So, it was a public performance that he had in mind, and I think that he expected to be admired for it by much of the country.
It's of course, it's an endlessly fascinating story, and that particular part of the story, as we've been saying, is a very small part of your book. And now, you mentioned in your acknowledgement that you had a lot of early readers of your manuscript. And from the blurbs, we know that, you know, a lot of great authors read and enjoyed Booth. But now your book is out there and readers like me are getting it. Is that scary? Is that anything like going on?
Oh, it's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
You can't fix it anymore. Is it like going on stage and performing with a sword, doing some Shakespeare?
Maybe to some extent, but the difference is, of course, that your book is permanent. You can, you know, if you blow a performance one night, you can try to do better the next. And that option isn't there for the book writer.
Yeah. So now you're going to tour. You're going to do a little book tour and people are going to talk to you. And has that started?
I'm doing something local here in Santa Cruz that's in person. And then I'm doing several virtual events this week. And then I go to England where the book comes out next week. And I'll be touring with that.
And
that is wide open. They don't seem to care about the virus anymore there. They don't seem to care if readers live or die. They'll all be in the same spaces together, breathing the same air.
Are you ready for that? I mean, you're doing. Yeah. Yeah,
I'm fully vaccinated. I trust it's all going to be fine.
Now, when you're working on a book like this one, which is obviously a major undertaking, and you've written many books, 6 novels, right? Are there a bunch of novels that are like inside your head saying, "Hey, what about me? Don't forget about me. I you need to write me next."
No, I wish that were the case. I am at the moment, I am completely bone dry of ideas. I've not started another project. I don't know what another project might look like. It's been a while since I finished Booth, even though it's just coming out today. Obviously, I finished it quite some time ago. So I'm beginning to get a little panicked that I don't know what I'm doing next. But I don't have a surfeit of ideas that I can move through. I get one at a time if I'm lucky.
Now, one thing that you and I share in common is and I'm sure many other people, is a love of non-human primates. I was involved with the Gorilla Foundation for a long time, and I worked with Coco, the gorilla who could communicate in American Sign Language.
That must have been fascinating.
It was.
I assume you met Coco then.
Oh, yeah, we were very good friends, actually. And I mean, really good friends, actually.
I envy you that.
And I work with Ndume as well. But you're interested in chimpanzees, and you have a chimpanzee that you're personally involved with?
Well, I foster a chimp, a rescued chimp. He's in Sierra Leone at a preserve. And I get monthly updates. I get pictures of him and personality assessments. Reminds me when my kids were in nursery school, the teachers would write out, you know, a little, Ryan is really enjoying playing on the bikes, they're similar sorts of reports. His name is Caesar, and I gather that he's kind of shy.
Oh, but you haven't actually met him yet.
No, I don't expect that I will.
How did you get interested in that?
I got interested in it as I wrote We're All Completely Beside Ourselves. It's a fascination that rose out of the research for doing that book.
Wonderful. Well, this new book, Karen Joy Fowler, is called Booth, and I love it. I really love it.
Thank you.
It was a journey that I was looking forward to, and even though it was, I'm not saying that the book is like in any way a burden in its length. I'm saying that it was long, but not long enough. Because
when well, thank you. And it strikes me as it's by far the longest book I've ever written. And I told you I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I do know whatever it is, it will be short. It will be a very short book.
Not a sequel to this one.
Not a sequel, no. I'm done with the booths.
Now that's an interesting thing to say. Do you think that they will leave you alone, or do you think they'll still be a part of you for a long time?
I think that I'll always be interested in them, and I expect that I will do my best to keep up. There are some websites that are devoted to this family, and one of the surprising things, given how much attention has been paid to these people over the years, one of the things that surprised me is that new things are still being discovered about them. I expect I will watch for those things, but just sort of like you would, you know, just like people you get a Christmas letter from, you're interested.
But, have you, in your research, did you go to Ford's Theater and see the display with the gun and the piece of skull?
I did not. I've been there before, long ago. But I did go to Tudor Hall, which is where the Booth family lived on their farm. That's now a museum devoted to the Booths. And there's a wonderful staff of people working there and a lot of really interesting local research that people have done that is available at that museum. I went there twice.
I have to go there now. I'm going to put it on my list of places to go if I ever go anywhere ever again.
They have a lecture series, so you should look. You should pick the day you're going to go so that you hear the lecture that will interest you the most.
This book is called Booth, a Novel, and the author is Karen Joy Fowler. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you, Gary. I've enjoyed it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.